the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I was looking at the numbers, Dave, and over the last several days, the U.S. Mint has sold more silver American Eagles than in the entire month of July. I mean, we're talking several million coins. Somebody must know something, even though prices have been going down.
Here's the contrast between the way futures traders feel about the market and actual demand for the metal itself. You have sentiment for gold, for instance, which is at a 27-year low.
Yeah. It's incredibly 5%, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. 5%, that's daily sentiment index for gold. It registers a 27-year low, and yet we are seeing demand, physical demand for the metals.
Right.
But in the futures pits, what's the sentiment? Prices going down, and it's going down further. There's a different kind of investor that looks at it and says, I like ounces. I'll be adding to ounces. If you're going to give them to me cheaper, that means I have to spend less money for the same ounces. This is beautiful. Or alternatively, more ounces for the same money.
We talked about silver. That's not excluding the gold side. They're also having record numbers of sales on the gold side as well.
That's right.
Well, the beauty of being able to see both markets, you can see the futures market and you can see that they've driven the price down and maybe they'll drive it down a little bit lower. We get to see the physical market. We see that we have demand. We see the demand going over to China. We see the demand also going over to India, Russia. We get to talk to our clients. Probably the best questions that are asked are really not what you find on financial TV.
That happens every day. I mean, just in the course of our daily operations, we have great questions that are asked. And I would just mention that over the last 6-7 years of doing this weekly commentary, we have had a special time of the year towards the third or fourth quarter where we have a segment called Your Questions Answered. We at least take a stab or an attempt at addressing either your questions or inquiries about everything from politics, geopolitics, and in some instances, clearly it would be out of our depth, and we can refer that to one of the guests that we have subsequently on the program and try to make sure that those are answered. But we look forward to that, and what I would encourage you to do as the listening audience is go ahead and write down your questions over the next few weeks. We're going to take the next 2 to 3 weeks, we'll remind you next week and the week after that, to be sending in your questions. And then as we head into the month of November, we will address those in the weekly commentary.
And those questions can be sent to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com.
That's McIlvaney, McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. And again, doesn't matter if you think it's a big question, a little question, any question is a good question as far as we're concerned. And if your question ends up being very similar to another one, we may not read it off precisely, but we will have them grouped together in that way. But we look forward to getting them. It proves to us each year just how remarkable our audience is, how engaged our audience is in almost every field of endeavor. And so we appreciate you, appreciate your curiosity and questions, and we'll do our very best to get you an answer to those here in the next few weeks.
Well, I'm going to jump right in. A question that we have often coming in is, how far can gold go down before it goes up, or how far can the equity market go up? And let's talk about the equity market, the stock market right now, because it seems that's where everybody is.
We may be near peak levels in the equity markets that represent the high water marks that hold for years. And I mean years to come. You may recall that the long-term peaks that we've seen over the last 100 years, they have held for a decade or more, which would come at a very inconvenient time for retirees, for baby boomers, if we were to see a severe market sell-off.
Until this year, this was called the lost decade. I mean, from the stock market point of view, we lost 10 years of growth in the stock market.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you're looking at sort of the performance numbers from the year 2000 forward, gold's up 230%, even with the severe correction. The S&P and Dow, call it 30%, 25 to 30%. And that includes, of course, the benefits of last year's growth and this year's growth, which have kind of put it to those positive numbers. Otherwise, you are, as you describe, looking at a lost decade. Now, the reality is we've seen a deterioration in the economy. We've seen a deterioration in credit flows, an expansion in money and credit. We've seen dead incomes for better than 15 years, where we have not seen income growth. So we're not getting the kind of economic energy that would drive or propel stock prices higher, although we have had monetary energy.
Well, it's the printing of money, Dave. I mean, there's no productivity there. That's just pure printing of money.
Now, back to that issue of it being sort of an inconvenient timing for retirees and baby boomers, the recovery in equities thus far has put back and changed some of the extreme pension funds, which were underfunded and, you could say, pitiful, a bit of a joke. But on average, if you're looking at sort of your state pension funds, they're still about 40% underfunded at present. And that's with the benefit of a major asset price increase. So listen, valuations on stocks, theoretically, they can move to more extreme levels that would parallel the year 2000. And yes, that would imply higher stock market values from here. But we anticipate weakness over the next several months, which should extend into several years of consolidation. So if we were to just take a guess, our first stop is 14,500 in the Dow, somewhere between 14,500 and 15,000.
So we're talking from around 17,000 where we've been at, down to about 14,500?
Yep. Then that actually is, although it sounds like a big decline, it's a modest decline. A more thorough decline would take us towards 12,500. And that is only a 25% decline, whereas significant declines over the last 10 to 15 years have been closer to 50%, not 25%. And that's what makes this last 5 years such a remarkable period of time. It's 5 years with nary a 10% correction. And that, again, compliments of the Fed, you've had artificial inputs which have sort of smoothed out the downside. As in when we do have a correction, and the tendency to see a decline in equities has come at the end of QE1 and QE2. Here we are on the cusp of QE3 being wrapped up, and it doesn't guarantee that the stock prices, S&P down, NASDAQ go down, but should we see that margin debt number, for instance, begin to accelerate liquidations, and we could have sort of a cycle of reinforced selling. A 50% decline that rivaled 2001 or 2008-09, what we've seen two of already in the last 10 to 15 years, would have the Dow breaching 10,000.
Well, and you bring up the Dow. Okay, so let's say that we're with the Federal Reserve and we're looking at indexes and we're saying, all right, what are people watching? Because we can't control everything. Let's go ahead and make sure the Dow is looking good or some of the smaller indexes. But Dave, when you broaden your scope and stop looking at the small dials on the dashboard, you start seeing that some of these stock indexes have been falling now for a while.
Yeah, and what's interesting is there's less participation. And I'm not just talking about volumes, which we did cover a few weeks ago. We're talking about new highs that are being set. If you look at the number of stocks that participate in an index, and you see the index rising, you assume that everybody in the mix is doing pretty well. Quite to the contrary, what we've seen is fewer and fewer of those companies pushing to new highs. In other words, you have this divergence between a few large companies that continue to press the index higher, but with a larger number actually beginning to fade. So you look at the dominoes that have already fallen, and maybe we could look at this sort of in order of quality from lowest to highest, or market cap from smallest to biggest. You've got the Russell 2000. The Russell 2000 is a small cap index, just small companies, small capitalization, very small market value. And they hit a peak in early March of this year, and they've been in decline ever since. Now we have right around 50% of the companies in the Russell 2000, which have already declined by more than 20% from their peaks. And according to the Mandarins of our day, they would say, okay, well, there you have it. A 20% decline from peak, that defines you're in a bear market.
That's
that particular stock's trading in a bear market.
Yeah.
So we have half of your small cap companies already in bear market territory. You've got utilities, which had a closing high at the end of June and are no better since then. You've got the S&P mid-caps, the S&P 400, not the S&P 500, which are your biggest companies. Guess what? They peaked in early July.
Well, and even the Dow seems to have maybe put in a peak.
Peaked in September 19th, and you know, we'll see if that holds or we take that out. In addition, when we were talking about small caps, we could have also talked about high yield bonds in terms of the quality categorization. High yields have been in decline for 2 months. And this is what's really interesting. Just as in 2008, gold and silver have sold off upfront. potentially leading the entire financial universe to lower levels. And if you recall, it was only gold which recovered in 2008 to finish positive for the year, but as a leading indicator, as something that said, hey, wait a minute, guys, everybody's getting liquid, and it doesn't matter what it is. If it's not nailed down, it's getting sold. Everything started to sell off in the early fall of 2008, again, with a healthy recovery by the year end for gold. But what does this say to us? What are the markets telling us? If we had to boil this down, could you boil it down to two words? Everybody remembers the shortest verse in the Bible, right? Jesus wept. Well, two words today. Be cautious.
Well, you know, Dave, if this was just a game and it was just for Wall Street people, it wouldn't be so important. But I mean, we're talking about a large percentage of household income right now is in the stock market. It gets huge right before we usually have a crash.
So be cautious. Have cash on hand. Offset your Yellen management of the cash position that you have. I mean, if it sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, maybe I am. I mean, I'm suggesting you increase your cash position. I'm also increasing that you have a sufficient insurance on that cash position because, listen, we've got the usual central bank foibles, which require a precious metals hedge.
Yeah, it is important to be cautious. I remember 2008. You know, we talked about questions that our clients had, and it was some of the questions that were coming in 2008 because the stock market was peaking and falling. Gold was falling. And the question was, wait a second, I thought gold goes up contrary to the stock market. Well, sure enough, it did. We saw the same thing in 1987. We saw gold come down a little bit and then end much higher in the October crash of 87. Saw the same thing in 2008. So what you're saying right now is the stock market seems to have been putting in some peaks. It could go higher, but gold being down is not a reason not to own gold. It's a form of owning cash so that when the crash comes, even if gold does go down slightly or at the same time, it recovers typically much quicker.
Well, and it recovers for the right reasons because people are thinking first in terms of liquidity and second in terms of quality.
Yeah.
Liquidity is, in any sort of a deflationary scare at least, your first priority because you haven't really sorted through what debt obligations you're going to keep or not keep. I mean, there are times where investors just say, I'm going to have to let that go.
Right.
Whether it's the second car or the boat or, you know, you say to yourself, do we really, really, really need the second home? I mean, there are hard financial decisions that are made, but you begin to prioritize. On first blush, people look at all the debt obligations they have and they try to keep all of the debt obligations in motion because they assume with a very positive attitude that this too shall pass. This is a short correction, not a big deal.
So they'll burn cash. They may even sell gold because it's so liquid.
In order to raise cash. And that's
yeah.
The point is that an initial hit is not something to be scared of because what you have is a reappraisal shortly thereafter. That reappraisal is critical. This was sort of dinner table conversation growing up because we talk about the merits of owning gold. We talk about how it performs in an inflation versus a deflation. And my dad's argument was gold is the metal for all seasons. In a deflation, even if it has an initial sell-off, people come back to it, flocking to it when they begin to see systemic risk, when they begin to prioritize the debt payments that they are or are not going to make and realize they need something that acts as an anchor to windward in the context of financial chaos and a financial storm.
Well, and Dave, you were talking about a stock market sell-off could be substantial, but you know, if you look on any year that the stock market had a crash, usually the percentage of stocks to household assets was about a third or more of the household assets. Aren't we there right now?
Yeah, that's consistent with high valuation. So if you're talking about cyclically adjusted price earnings ratios, which are high but not extreme, these are all numbers which could go higher. But again, what you just mentioned, a percentage of household assets, which were made up of stocks and mutual funds, these come from Federal Reserve reported numbers. Right now, that is 34.4% of household financial assets. Mm. That is, stocks and mutual funds make up just over a third of household financial assets. There's only one number which ever has registered higher, and that's the year 2000, when it was 39% of household assets.
And that was right before it crashed.
Precisely, which were in mutual funds and stocks. And so we're close to all-time records. Of course, they could go higher, but we're awfully close already. Both in nominal terms and as a percentage of GDP, we've talked about margin debt, which has exceeded all past records. So what are you looking for as a bargain hunter? What did we discuss a few weeks ago as exceptional values? Well, the reality is they're few and far between. So you look at sentiment, very high sentiment in the stock market. Contrast that with what we mentioned about gold in our first remarks, very, very low. And so you look at high sentiment in the stock market, you look at high valuations, you look at the absence of bargains. And as an investor, what am I looking for? When people hate stocks, companies have suffered through a bear market, you'll usually see that household number between 10 and 15%.
Well, and that's when Buffett is buying. Remember, we talked how Buffett, the last 2 years, he's been sitting out this market.
That's right. So fear dominates the market in that environment. The vast majority have lost money. They're in a demoralized fashion, throwing in the towel. And that is what Buffett described as irresistible value. What do we intend to do at that point? Swapping ounces for shares, I think, in that environment will provide an exceptional increase in purchasing power and an exceptional expansion in terms of a family's or individual's financial footprint. Currently, we have the pendulum at the wrong end to consider that kind of a move. Again, you've got low sentiment in the gold market, very high sentiment in the stock market, high valuations in the stock market, percentage participation, percentage ownership in terms of household assets, again, 34.4 versus a peak of 39.4. Maybe we get there in the next reported number. Maybe we're actually marching there as we speak, because of course these numbers are reporting a past state of affairs. We may be at 39 now, but you know, history will tell us better if that's the case.
And you know, I think it's important sometimes to not look at the last peak on gold and measure everything from the last peak, because if we were just measuring the Dow in gold, like we've discussed in the past, back in the year 2000, Dave, it was 43 ounces of gold. That's what the Dow was worth. Today, the Dow's only worth about 13 or 14 ounces of gold. But the greater move, actually mathematically, is ahead of us, because you go from 13 or 14 ounces to 1 to maybe 3 to 1 or 2 to 1. That's larger than the move from 43 to 1 down to 14.
That's right. Yeah. In terms of a multiple expansion, in terms of that increased financial footprint, as I like to describe it, that's a trend we expect to reassert itself with the Dow gold ratio shrinking considerably into 2017. And yes, gold improves one's purchasing power in that environment. And by the way, that's entirely consistent with every period of past deflation in the last 600 years, where gold increased your financial footprint considerably. And, you know, again, so many are concerned that that is something to be worried about.
Dave, before the crash that we had in 1987 and then 2000 and even in 2008, there seemed to be a strong hopefulness. You had people watching CNBC and all the financial TV and saying, yeah, buying this tech stock or that tech stock. I remember back in the late 90s, there was just such a fervor for watching financial TV. CNBC is searching for anything to talk about right now, aren't they?
Well, they're searching for anything to talk about because their ratings are at 21-year lows. I mean, basically, viewership has dropped off a cliff.
Well, and no reflection on you, Dave. I know that you're a guest on CNBC every once in a while, and I'm sure
thank
their ratings
that.
Go up.
Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate that. But what's interesting is you've got this contrast with past peaks where the public was, as you describe, exuberant, hopeful. And the environment today is not one of exuberant hopefulness and expectation. It's one of desperate hopefulness. Because again, you've got baby boomers who are starting to jump ship from the workforce in earnest this year. And they need to capture the growth of the last several years to fund their retirement income and supplement their income with this sort of nest egg of savings in retirement accounts. CNBC ratings tell you that people are already nonplussed, non-interested with the markets. And if they are participating, are doing so with a lot less time spent day trading and sort of playing volatility as they were in the late 90s. It's a participation that's somewhat of a forced participation in the sense that they don't have many other options. Frankly, they'd rather be in bonds today. They'd rather be in CDs because they're getting ready to retire and they'd like to toggle back that risk metric. But guess what? There's no income to be had. There's nothing that's happening in the world of CDs and fixed income. So reluctantly, they're there. And the CNBC ratings, I think, are very telling. Because, again, for their ratings to be at 21-year lows and viewership to be abysmal, it just says that, again, there's a different kind of backdrop. And should we see a market decline, in equities, it's going to become not just a little flood, but a deluge of Noahic proportions.
Well, you know, if the stock market, even though it's been hitting new highs this last year, is a snoozer and less people are watching on CNBC, I've got to admit, Dave, this unseen hand that's got its hand on top of the gold market, talk about a snoozer as far as prices go. I mean, we had a little bit of gains. Now we're coming back down to where we may end the year just about where we started the year.
Right. So we're playing with the cyclical lows of 2013, 2014. We've basically not lost any ground from the beginning of the year, but we have given up the gains from the first quarter or two of the year. And again, this goes back to what we were describing earlier, the sentiment indicators. If you go to tradefutures.com, you have your trader sentiment on these items, and it's worth noting the market extremes, because on the one end, you had in August of 2011, with gold setting new all-time highs right at around 1900, listen to this, 98% of traders were bullish. Again, these are traders in the futures pits.
So all but 2% were saying it's going to continue up.
That's right. So 98% of traders were bullish. And guess what happens? 98%, well, simply, we ran out of buyers shortly thereafter. And what happens to any market when you run out of buyers? Now, we see as of the September 19th date, gold near 1,200, 5%.
Yeah.
Of traders are bullish. So this is one of the lowest readings ever, and I think it's reasonable to ask, just as we ran out of buyers at the top, are we running out of sellers? And I think we're very close to that. Yeah, obviously there's speculation which abounds about the idea of lower gold prices, and I think that's worthy of comment.
There are a handful of commentators right now that continually point out deflation and somehow tie the price of gold to a deflation. I think errantly they'll say, well, look at copper prices or look at lumber prices, look at the prices of other commodities. And they treat gold like a commodity, but you've pointed out in the past many times that deflation is actually the environment for gold.
Well, this is wonderfully complex and the ideal scenario for a gold owner, although it's a multi-step sequence in terms of the rationale. Deflation improves your purchasing power. Think about that just in cash terms. If you have $100 in your bank account and the price of assets is going down, guess what? Your $100 goes further. Now, in the past periods of deflation, you know, so 1930s and then stretching back into the 19th century, the 18th century, the 17th century, going back 600 years, what you find is that your reference point for cash was not actually greenbacks with nothing but the central bank promise backing it.
They were a receipt for gold.
We were talking about cash and gold being one and the same thing.
You're right.
So your purchasing power did improve in the context of past deflations, but in every instance of past deflation, gold was money. Money was gold. The move towards money was a move towards gold.
We have not had a deflation when we've been off the gold standard, am I right?
That's right. And so there's a misunderstanding in terms of the history of money and perhaps the nomenclature. You're moving gold into a commodity category, which is to basically separate it out from the role that it's played for 5,000 years and say, oh no, something's very different since 1971. It has to be treated as a commodity, not a currency, because in 1971, didn't you know that Richard Nixon disconnected gold from the currency world? Well, I'm sorry, an arbitrary decision to disconnect gold from the currency world does not eradicate or make it irrelevant in terms of its long-term role, past, present, and future, in terms of the world money system.
So it's good to measure things, anything, whether you're buying a house, stocks, or whatever, in ounces of gold and see if you're gaining buying power or losing buying power. Whether gold is rising or falling in dollars, that's irrelevant.
You know, we had Sir Charles Vollum on the program a few years ago, and we've had some great private conversations in a couple different places around the world where we've met up, where his website, Priced in Gold, gives you a real insight into the fact that we've already been through one of the worst deflations in recorded history. If you treat gold as money, as I think you should, you'll see that the cost of things has come down considerably for the saver in gold ounces.
Relative to ounces of gold.
Right. So you may be concerned about deflation and concerned about the nominal value of the gold price. Go to Priced in Gold and study every one of his charts. And what you'll see is that actually the gold owner has done quite well, and I think will continue to do quite well in terms of an improvement in purchasing power. Vollum would echo our sentiment that at a certain point, you spend your cash on assets that are dirt cheap. Now, when does that transition occur? When you're selling ounces for other assets?
Right, and you're calling cash ounces of gold.
Precisely, and I think that's still in a 2017 to 2018 time frame. Maybe it's 2016. But, you know, listen, we don't know how this history will be written in specific details. We do know that once currencies were unhinged from gold in 1914, since then, we have experienced all the episodes of hyperinflation in world history.
Well, now, wait a second. There have been high inflation episodes with Rome, with Greece. Are you talking high inflation or hyperinflation?
Hyperinflationary scenarios.
Well, what is hyperinflation then?
Right. Well, we'll discuss this in detail in the coming weeks with, frankly, the expert on hyperinflations. He's from the University of Basel in Switzerland, Peter Bernholtz. Simply put, you've got monthly inflation rates of 50% or greater. That's how he would define hyperinflation. Monthly inflation rates of 50% or more. And he'd say, listen, we've had about 30 of those in world history, and they all fall from 1914 to the present day. All hyperinflations in world history fall within the context of fiat money and the failure of faith. Again, all within the last 100 years. So, yes, you've got the preconditions of a massive budget deficit. You've got loose monetary policies. Those are common elements. But we'll explore some of that in greater depth with Peter here in the next couple of weeks.
Well, and we have to define the difference between high inflation, inflation, and hyperinflation because, okay, 50% or greater rise per month, that is hyperinflation. But that's never caused by growth in an economy, Dave. That's a loss of faith in the currency, isn't it?
Well, right. And most of your Wall Street guys and gals, analysts on the street, some of my best friends would say, hey, listen, we don't see any wage inflation, therefore we will not have inflation. And that's all well and good. That's one way to get to higher rates of inflation is to see wage increases first. But that's not always what you see at the front edge. And as we'll explore with Dr. Bernholtz, that's actually not where your hyperinflations come from. Your hyperinflations are sourced very, very differently. So the money mandarins, the monetary mandarins of our day, these are the central bankers, they would like to keep the masses mesmerized. And what are they doing that with? They're doing that with theatrics. They're doing that with euphemisms. They're doing that with sleight of hand in terms of changing the definitions of words or referencing old concepts as new things. I mean, let's face it. We know that debt monetization has been a cause of superinflation and hyperinflation consistently through time.
But we don't do that. We quantitatively ease.
We quantitatively ease. We don't monetize debt. Now, literally, that's what we're talking about, is theatrics and euphemisms. Verbal sleight of hand, and the general public says, and that's right, we have no, and nor will we have, inflation into the future. Listen, this sort of little side note or diversion, what I've tried to do is over the next couple of weeks, I want to set up a discussion between Peter Bernholtz on the one hand, and in one of my favorite interviews that we have each year, once a year, a friend of ours, Russell Napier. He'll join us to discuss deflation and the structural changes in the current account deficit and the highly probable collapse of the emerging market economies in what he feels is sort of the ceiling of the fate of the early 21st century. This part of our economic history will be one of the most extreme deflations on record. Now, if any of you are hyperventilating, he has an interesting conclusion here. And that is that central bankers are no longer prudes when it comes to money printing. And this remains the long-term outlook. Deflationary collapse, triggering central bank activism on a scale never witnessed globally, and in concert, because now we're not talking about just the Fed, we're talking about a variety of central banks all operating in the same vein. Let me ask you this. When the globe is experiencing a money printing mania all at once, where will the smart money already be?
Right. Well, we're seeing it, Dave. I mean, it's not the small stock trader who's buying gold right now. Okay. These are the large governments that are preparing for this very event.
I have a family member, one of the smarter gentlemen that I know. If you could just measure a subset of IQ, sort of business acumen, this is a guy who has been successful over and over and over and over again. And he loves operating businesses. And he's very good at operating businesses. And he's very good at seeing potential growth and getting in early and getting out before it's too late. And it's interesting because I had a conversation with this family member, distant relative, and he said to me the other day, he said, Dave, you know, I'm thinking about making a major acquisition of gold. And I said, well, you're not alone. The number of large purchases of 400-ounce good delivery bars is on the increase considerably. What is that an indication of?
Mm-hmm.
Big money interests, very wealthy individuals basically saying, I need X percent in gold. I don't care what the price is. Frankly, I don't care if the price goes up, down. I just want ounces because it's a real asset. And I think, frankly, it's probably gotten too cheap. Suffice it to say, I lose more sleep over not owning enough ounces than over the short-term volatility in the metals market. And that short-term volatility, it's driven by the good men and women of the world's central banks with wingnut theories about what drives long-term sustainable economic growth.
In our conversation last week with Joseph Tainter, he was talking about how a system can become so complex that nobody actually can exit the system. So, you know, when you're talking about these central bankers, I think a lot of times, and we've talked to them here on the show, a lot of times they're doing the very best they can in a system that they know is not going to sustain itself forever.
Right. So you're basically doing the best you can with what you've got.
Well, how about Mario Draghi then? Okay. Is he doing the best he can with what he's got, or is he just insane?
Last week, he's offered up, you know, $1.3 trillion in assets to be purchased. And, you know, the market was not particularly impressed. I mean, anymore, what it takes to impress the market, it's like going to a downtown urban venue where crack addicts need more and more to get the same job done. If you're offering the same old trillions, it just doesn't do it anymore. You're not going to excite me.
He's like, hey, let's buy some Greek debt. Let's buy some Cypriot debt. Let's buy from Cyprus.
Well, and that actually stirred some concern, of course, amongst German voters, because what is he really talking about? To buy Greek and Cypriot debt, you're talking about buying stuff that doesn't have the credit standards, credit credentials, to act as quality collateral for additional loans from the ECB. Let's back up here. We're talking about the ECB saying banks who are sitting on garbage paper but need fresh liquidity, what you can do is you can take your garbage paper, give it to us, we'll give you fresh loans, and we'll just use that garbage paper as collateral for the loan. We don't care that it's garbage because we're going to make up the rules on our own terms and for your benefit. And this is what some have described as the equivalent of a bad bank proposal. They're attempting to take the debt that could never be accepted as collateral for even more loans to free up liquidity for those financial institutions. And this is what I would describe as the clothespin proposal. You just hold your nose and spend the money. Other people's money, of course, and fresh off the printing presses. And this is why you've got a lot of German voters and German politicians, frankly, who say, hey, wait a minute. Is that the role of the ECB? Wait a minute. We are the largest contributor to the ECB, and we are the legitimizer of the ECB because, as you recall, the German mark was the most stable currency and was the necessary linchpin to make the European Monetary Union work in the first place. And they're concerned. They're very concerned because they are dealing with all kinds of issues. Not only do they not want to subsidize Cyprus and subsidize Greece, the Germans don't, but they have their own issues. Inflation is sliding again. It's 0.3% is the most recent number. That's in the euro area for September, 0.3%. That's the lowest in 5 years. And that's with a lot of efforts to try to boost inflation. And yet we're seeing this sort of deflationary trend in Europe. Regardless, we had industrial production in Germany. Industrial production numbers dropped in the most recent report, the most since 2009. It was a greater than 4% decline. So there are reasons for Europeans to worry. The answer does not lie in debt monetization.
Well, yeah, it seems that liquidity, 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 it's the helicopter answer every single time. And the only way they're getting away with it right now, Dave, is that people still have faith in the currency to some degree.
You've got a lot of investors and asset managers who have surmised that the ECB is going to back the asset markets. Particularly Mario Draghi, with his background at Goldman Sachs, he knows how to butter everyone's bread. And he's going to back the asset markets and create a wealth effect by boosting liquidity, backstopping the credit markets, and they've assumed that the markets in Europe are a one-way bet.
Mm-hmm. There's that certainty again that we've talked about.
Right. And it's certainty based on a faith in the ability of the central banker at the helm to deliver. And there is so much money today, tens of trillions of dollars, bet on the success of a few frail men.
Okay, but let's say that you're in that position, Dave. Okay, and you don't have to satisfy voters. You just come in and say, all right, I've got a solution. What would your solution be?
Allow unhealthy loans to go the direction of the dodo bird. Allow them to fail. You've got to stop increasing moral hazard. Allow those debts to be liquidated. You know, setting up a bad bank, all that encourages investors to do is speculate further in riskier asset classes because they know there really is no consequence to taking greater risk. You know, the whole concept in investing is that the greater risk that you take, in theory, there is a greater reward. But what has happened with central bank intervention, both the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, is that the central banks have basically eliminated half of the mathematical equation.
Right.
You no longer have risk, you just have the reward. So why not maximize your reward since risk has been accommodated, taken care of? Again, this is that notion of moral hazard. Who cares about the consequences of bad choices or bad investments when those consequences have been muted or been taken away altogether?
Okay, but I'm going to play the other side here. Everyone's going to say, all right, that's just going to create deflation, Dave. If you allow all those debts to go away, that would be a debt implosion that would create severe deflation. I mean, they've kept us afraid of deflation all the years that they've been printing money.
Deflation is bad for very wealthy investors who have assets.
And governments who want to tax those assets.
Particularly if the government has been financing itself using debt, because debt becomes much more of a burden in the context of a deflation. But for the poor and the middle class, do you know what this represents? It represents an increase in purchasing power.
Right.
Again, whether your cash is actual greenback dollars or ounces, what you're really looking at is the world getting cheaper. And last time I checked, if the world gets cheaper and your income doesn't increase, it really is like getting a pay raise. So what's not to like about a pay raise? You are talking about people who have extended credit without regard for credit quality being at risk. So you're talking about a significant loss in the banking sector. You're talking about a significant loss in Wall Street. You're talking about many wealthy investors losing their speculative dollars. But here's what I would say to that. Losing money on a speculation, big boys and big girls out there, you knew it was a possibility.
That's why it was called a speculation, Dave.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so this is the imaginary world of deflation. My wife comes home and says, hey, Kev, I don't really need that $300 this week for groceries. I only need $200. Things are getting cheaper. Now, how is that bad for me? It's like what you're saying. I'm not speculating on groceries. I'm actually gaining more groceries.
Well, it's the exact opposite of what has been happening in an inflationary environment. And you realize the absurdity of central bank policies, which are targeting an increase in inflation. They're basically saying, I don't care if your income is going up or not. What I do care about is economic growth, which maybe somewhere down the line will increase your income, which frankly, over the last 15 years, it hasn't proven to. Nonetheless, they have targeted 2% rates of inflation per year, and that means that everything you buy in the store is more expensive. The last 5 years, I spoke with a gentleman who works with us on our wealth management platform and our precious metals as a client in both companies. And he said, Dave, you know, it's interesting. You know, I take some funds out each month to supplement my retirement income. In the last 5 years have been very frustrating because I'm not living any more extravagantly, but I'm going to have to start drawing out more because the cost of everything is going up. And you know what? This is what's interesting. Government and the Fed, all of our global central banks have said that is acceptable. That's what we want, is the cost of things going up. And frankly, the deflationary scenario is not a bad one for a consumer. When things get cheaper, that's not all bad.
Well, and you know, with low official inflation rates, no one really considers the future anyway. I mean, only present matters. And what you bring up about this gentleman who's retired and he's getting nervous, things are still costing more, yet he's being told that we're in a deflation.
But on the flip side, you have central banks who continue to promise the power of the printing press. And yes, we have low official rates of inflation in Europe. Yes, we have low official inflation rates here in the United States. And no one's really considering the future. What are the implications of the printing press policies that are already in place? Again, only the present matters. Only the present matters. Which really is how you sow not only inflationary trends in the future, but potentially hyperinflationary trends. The vast quantities of bad debt today, yes, overwhelm the trillions in liquidity that the world central banks have created. But a sharp transition in velocity of money turns an inadequate supply of liquidity into an excess of liquidity as supplies on hand move up exponentially in terms of their total scale in the marketplace.
You can't separate deflation and inflation completely, because a lot of times you'll see these hyperinflations occur right after a short deflationary period. And the deflation is actually caused from a lack of cash, and then when there's a response to that, people lose faith in the cash because the central bankers just come up with too much of it.
Well, when we discuss sort of the structural long-term changes with Russell Napier next week, one thing we will explore is the demise of the existing world monetary system. Central bankers are working today in an environment where they have the benefit of public confidence. That's the benefit that they have today. There are, even as we speak, certain structural shifts, now actually 5 years old, 5 years mature, they're behind us. And those structural shifts are growing in their impact that I think will ultimately undermine the work of our modern day central banker, undermining their reputation. And this is critical to appreciate, because as we've described before, confidence and faith in the money men and women of our day has been a critical element in alleviating volatility in the markets and creating a real sense of calm.
You can imagine, Dave, if something happened today where people said, oh my goodness, I can't trust the Fed. I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know whether they're going to be able to react to this next problem. And, you know, you wonder how many times they're going to run out of ammunition and come up with some new rabbit out of the hat.
We could only hope they run out of ammunition, because frankly, what happens internationally is often that that's when they start making more and more of it. You know, when confidence in the class of central bankers collapses, and I think we're going to see that in the next few years, what will it be triggered by? Listen, every central bank has been fighting deflation, fighting it with every tool they have in the box. And when they lose grip, in spite of the massive efforts made to control it, you're going to see the general public reevaluate all of their investment and economic assumptions. And I think at that point, you are going to be faced with a series of currency devaluations globally, trade wars, individuals scrambling to cope with the impact of a deteriorating global monetary system. And listen, the dollar may be the less worse currency in that case, in a currency reset environment. But we ask you to consider the difference, the change of central bank monetary policy being implemented with the confidence of the general public, and then in an environment where confidence is already gone. So if that backdrop, confidence in the Fed is gone, now reevaluate the least worst currency in the currency market. And I think that's where you begin to see a significant move where wealthy and sophisticated investors concerned with systemic stability, concerned with the undermining not only of a domestic currency, but the entire global monetary system, look at a deflationary environment and see gold as a critical asset to own. Outside of the banking system, outside of the world monetary system now in flux, and outside of the reach of financial obligations, which they also may have. I mean, so again, you're talking about a financial asset that doesn't have financial ties. You tell me how important that's going to be in the future. I will tell you it'll be the most important thing you have on your balance sheet.
Well, you and I may be able to survive a deflation owning gold, and then a hyperinflation owning gold. Gold seems to do well in both occasions, but the emerging markets right now are completely dependent on the liquidity continuing to flow, are they not?
From us, specifically from us. So your emerging market equities, it was interesting. We've had this conversation in the management committee for the foundation for the college here in town that I help advise on. And the argument has been made, emerging market equities are cheaper than U.S. equities. Let's look at from a fundamental valuation perspective, and they're cheaper by half, cheaper by two-thirds in some instances. Well, they may have a lot further to fall, and there are several reasons for that. You've got the end of QE here in the U.S., which will tighten liquidity globally, unless other central bankers fill the gap. For as long as QE is off the table, or some other extreme monetary measure is off the table, you'll have a strengthening U.S. dollar, which acts as a restrictive monetary policy, a tightening monetary policy in any of your emerging markets, which have a tie currency-wise to the U.S. dollar. And where we'll explore at length in our conversation with Russell next week is a shrinking trade deficit means that we are exporting less dollar liquidity globally, which appears to be a long-term, not a short-term trend. Mm-hmm. So if you want to diversify out of U.S. equities because you think they are expensive, as we do, don't get cute and go buy emerging market equities just because they're cheaper. They are cheaper, and they may be cheaper for a reason. Well, and last but not least, you have to remember that should the U.S. equity markets roll over here in the next few weeks to months, global equity markets have proved to have a positive correlation. In other words, they move in the same direction at the same time, just to varying degrees. And in fact, that correlation to U.S. equities increases depending on the intensity of the selling pressure.
So you may sound like a broken record, Dave, but you are repeating those two words in this time frame that we're in right now. Those two words are be cautious.
Be cautious. Raise cash. I mean, all these are sort of two-word sentences. Buy gold. I mean, they're very simple. And yes, we're going to be cautious this next week. You and I are heading down to Argentina. We'll share some of our observations when we get back. We will be cautious on our journeys, of course, but I look forward to covering more of these details, particularly on the current account deficit with Russell Napier next week. If that sounds like a dry and uninteresting topic, just understand that it's probably the most critical thing to impact the global equity markets, the global debt markets in the last 30 years. So much more on that next week, and then we'll explore our observations on Argentina, currency trends, the difference between the blue market, that is the street rate for the Argentine peso and the official rates, and the ways in which Cristina Kirchner has absolutely decimated that country. That and more, next week's Weekly Commentary.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.